existing libraries as intellectual crossroads, bringing together people, ideas, knowledge, and information. I wish I could claim that concept as uniquely my own, but surely that was what Thomas Jefferson had in mind when he put library in the rotunda at the head of the lawn. Thus, it is a special pleasure for the library to sponsor this conversation with Richard Dawkins. Since we're all eager to get to the main event, I will just turn the podium over to him, Thompson, and thank you for making this program possible.
One of the most important science books of all time. That is how Selfish Eating was described in an essay in Nature this spring to mark the 30th anniversary of its publication. We're extraordinarily privileged today to have the author of Selfish Eating with us. And the format is very simple. He will speak for maybe half an hour and then we'll take questions. You'll see that there are microphones on either side. If you would please come down to the microphone to ask your question, he will recognize you. Please identify yourself and ask your question, and he'll respond. And it's my great privilege to introduce him. Born in Africa, in a sense where we were all born, educated at Oxford, student of the Nobel laureate Nicholas Hindenburg. He is currently the Charles Simonyi Professor for the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University. He's here today through the efforts of a lot of people. I would like to just take a second to recognize them and thank them, particularly the university librarian, Karin Wittenborg, but also from her staff in the building, Charlotte Morford, Ed Daner. I'd like to thank Wayne Zuliger, University Bookstore. There'll be a book signing following. You see Wayne, thank him. And also, particularly, Douglas Shedd, Professor of Biology at Randolph Macon Women's College. It's Professor Shedd who's responsible for having our speaker in the state of Virginia. Selfish Gene was just the beginning. His main contribution to biology was the extended phenotype that appeared in 1982, and The Blind Watchmaker, which won the Royal Society Literature Award. His other books include The River Out of Eden, Climbing Mount Improbable, a collection of essays, The Devil's Chaplain. In 2004, he published The Ancestor's Tale and became, in a sense, the Chaucer of life's history. He's here in this country now to mark the publication of his latest book, The God Delusion. His awards and honors are numerous, including the Kistler Prize, the Nakayama Prize for Achievement in Human Science, the Royal Society's Michael Faraday Award. He is a fellow of the Royal Society. Like Charles Darwin, he has made original contributions to science with great literary style. Like Charles Darwin, he invites us to see the astonishing complexity of nature. And like Darwin, he compels us to see the very nature of nature and our place in it. It is an extraordinary personal privilege to welcome to the university community and to introduce to you Richard Dawkins.
Campus, very beautiful it is. I particularly liked Brooks Hall, where I saw the names of Darwin and Huxley and Lyell and various other scientific luminaries inscribed. I'm traveling the country promoting my latest book, The God Delusion, and I've got a kind of standard app which consists of readings. I've modified that app for this afternoon because of the association with the 30th anniversary of the Selfish Gene, which Dr. Thompson just mentioned. So I'm going to extract from the God Delusion, in particular, those chapters which are relevant to the evolution of morality, and therefore have hark back, in a sense, 30 years to the Selfish Gene. But I'm going to begin with a passage from my standard act, which is from chapter 2 of the God Delusion. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. Those of us schooled from infancy in his ways have become desensitized to their horror. The naive, desperate perspective of innocence has a clearer perception. Winston Churchill's son, Randolph, somehow contrived to remain ignorant of scripture until even War and the brother officer, in a vain attempt to keep Churchill quiet when they were toasted together during the war, bet him he couldn't read the entire Bible in a fortnight. Unhappily, it has not had the result we hoped. He has never read any of it before and is hideously excited. He keeps reading quotations aloud. I said, I bet you didn't know this name in the Bible. Or merely slapping his side and chortling, God, isn't God a shit? Thomas Jefferson, better read, was of a similar opinion. The Christian God is a being of terrific character, cruel, vindictive, capricious, and unjust. Christianity prides itself on being a monotheistic religion, but you have to wonder sometimes. Rivers of medieval ink, not to mention blood, have been squandered over the mystery of the Trinity, and in suppressing deviations such as the Arian heresy. Arius of Alexandria, in the 4th century AD, denied that Jesus was consubstantial, i.e. of the same substance or essence, with God. What on earth could that possibly mean, you're probably asking? Substance? What substance? What exactly do you mean by essence? Very little seems the only reasonable reply. Yet the controversy split Christendom down the middle for a century, and the Emperor Constantine ordered that all copies of Arius' book should be burned, splitting Christendom by splitting hairs. Such has ever been the way of theology. Do we have one God in three parts or three gods in one? The Catholic Encyclopedia clears up the matter for us in a masterpiece of theological close reasoning. In the unity of the Godhead, there are three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, these three persons being truly distinct one from another. Thus, in the words of the Athanasian Creed, the Father is God, the Son is God, and the Holy Spirit is God. And yet there are not three gods, but one God. As if that were not clear enough, the Encyclopedia quotes the 3rd century theologian St. Gregory the Miracle Worker. There is therefore nothing created, nothing subject to another in the Trinity, nor is there anything that has been added as though it once had not existed but had ended afterwards. Therefore the Father has never been without the Son, nor the Son without the Spirit, and this same Trinity is immutable and unalterable forever. Whatever miracles may have earned St. Gregory his nickname, they were not miracles of honest lucidity. His words convey a characteristically obscurantist flavour of theology, which, unlike science or most other branches of human scholarship, has not moved on in 18 centuries. Thomas Jefferson has so often got it right when he said, ridicule is the only weapon which can be used against unintelligible propositions. Ideas must be distinct before reason can act upon them, and no man ever had a distinct idea of the Trinity. It is the mere abracadabra of the mountebanks calling themselves priests of Jesus. Jefferson heaped ridicule on the doctrine that, as he put it, there are three gods, in a critique of Calvinism. But it is especially the Roman Catholic branch of Christianity that pushes its recurrent flirtation with polytheism towards runaway inflation. The Trinity is, joined by Mary, Queen of Heaven, a goddess in all but name, who surely wants God himself a close second as a target of prayers. The pantheon is further spoken by an army of saints, whose intercessory power makes them, if not demigods, well worth approaching on their own specialist subjects. The Catholic Community Forum helped to list 5,120 saints, together with their areas of expertise, which include abdominal pains, abuse victims, anorexia, anorexia, arms dealers, blacksmiths, broken bones, bomb technicians, and bowel disorders. To venture no further than the bees. Pope John Paul II created more saints than all his predecessors of the past several centuries put together. And he had a special affinity for the Virgin Mary. His polytheistic hankerings were dramatically demonstrated in 1981 when he suffered an assassination attempt in Rome and attributed his survival to intervention by Our Lady of Fatima. A maternal hand guided the bullet. One cannot help wondering why she didn't guide it to miss him altogether. Others might think the team of surgeons who operated on him for 6 hours deserve at least a share of credit. But perhaps their hands, too, were maternally guided. The relevant point is that it wasn't just Our Lady who, in the Pope's opinion, guided the bullet, but specifically Our Lady of Fatima. Presumably Our Lady of Lourdes, Our Lady of Guadalupe, Our Lady of Medjugorje, Our Lady of Akita, Our Lady of Zaitun, Our Lady of Garabandal, and Our Lady of Knock were busy on other errands. I'm now going to turn to a section which I haven't read about before, which I'm calling Morality and the Selfish Gene, and which is chosen from various parts of the Darwinian tradition. On the face of it, the Darwinian idea that evolution is driven by natural selection seems ill-suited to explain such goodness as we possess, or our feelings of morality, decency, empathy, and pity. Natural selection can easily explain hunger, fear, and sexual lust, all of which straightforwardly contribute to our survival or the preservation of our genes. But what about the wrenching compassion we feel when we see an orphan child weeping, an old widow in despair from loneliness, or an animal whimpering in pain? What gives us the powerful urge to send an anonymous gift of money or clothes to tsunami victims on the other side of the world whom we shall never meet, and who are unlikely to return the favor? Where does the good Samaritan in us come from? Isn't goodness incompatible with the theory of the selfish gene? No, this is a common misunderstanding of the theory, a distressingly and with hindsight foreseeable misunderstanding. It is necessary to put the stress on the right word. The selfish gene is the correct emphasis, for it makes the contrast with the selfish organism, say, or the selfish species. The most obvious way in which genes ensure their own selfish survival relative to other genes is by programming individual organisms to be selfish. But different circumstances favor different tactics. There are circumstances, not particularly rare, in which genes ensure their own selfish survival by influencing organisms to behave altruistically. Those circumstances are now fairly well understood, and they fall into two main categories. A gene that programs individual organisms to favor their genetic kin is statistically likely to benefit copies of itself. The other main type of altruism for which we have the well worked out Darwinian rationale is reciprocal altruism. You scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. The principle is the basis of all trade and barter in humans. The hunter needs a spear and the smith wants meat. The asymmetry brokers a deal. The bee needs nectar, and the flower needs pollinating. Flowers can't fly, so they pay bees in the currency of nectar for the hire of their wings. Birds called honeybees can't find bees' nests. Can find bees' nests, but can't break into them. Honey badgers, ratels, can break into bees' nests, but lack wings with which to search for them. Honeybees lead ratels, and sometimes men, to honey, by a special enticing flight used for no other purpose. Both sides benefit from the transaction. A crock of gold may lie under a large stone, too heavy for its discoverer to move. He enlists the help of others, even though he then has to share the gold, because without their help he would get none. The living kingdoms are rich in such mutualistic relationships. Buffaloes and oxpeckers, red tubular flowers and hummingbirds, groupers and keen oasis, powers in their gut microorganisms. reciprocal altruism works because of asymmetries in needs and incapacities to meet them. That is why it works especially well between different species. The asymmetries are greater. In humans, IOUs and money are devices that permit delays in the transactions. The parties to the trade don't hand over the goods simultaneously, but can hold a debt over to the future, or even trade the debt on to others. As far as I know, no non-human animals in the wild have any direct equivalent of money, but memory of individual identity plays the same role more informally. Vampire bats learn which other individuals of their social group can be relied upon to pay their debts in regurgitated blood, and which individuals cheat. That of selection favors genes that predispose individuals in relationships of asymmetric need and opportunity to give when they can and to solicit giving when they can't. It also favors tendencies to remember obligations, bear grudges, police exchange relationships, and punish cheats who take but don't give when their turn comes. Through most of our prehistory, humans lived under conditions that would have strongly favored the evolution of altruism. We lived in villages or earlier in discrete roving bands like baboons, partially isolated from neighboring bands or villages. Most of your fellow band members would have been kin, more closely related to you than members of other bands. Plenty of opportunities for kin altruism to evolve. And whether kin or not, you would tend to meet the same individuals again and again throughout your life. Ideal conditions for the evolution of reciprocal altruism. It is therefore easy to see why our prehistoric ancestors would have been good to their own in-group, but bad, to the point of xenophobia, towards other groups. But why, now that most of us live in big cities where we are no longer surrounded by kin, and where every day we meet individuals whom we are never going to meet again, why are we still so good to each other, even sometimes to others who might be thought to belong to an out-group? It is important not to mistake the reach of natural selection. Selection does not favor the evolution of a cognitive awareness of what is good for your genes. That awareness had to wait for the 20th century, and even now, full understanding is confined to a minority of scientific specialists. What natural selection favors is rules of thumb, which work in practice to promote the genes that build them. Rules of thumb, by their nature, sometimes misfire. In a bird's brain, the rule, look after small squawking things in your nest and drop food into their red cakes, typically has the effect of preserving the genes that built the rule, because the squawking, gaping object in an adult bird's nest are normally its own offspring. The rule misfires if another baby bird somehow gets into the nest, a circumstance that is positively engineered by cuckoos. Could it be that our good Samaritan urges are misfirings, analogous to the misfiring of a rewarmless parental instincts when it works itself to the bone for a young cuckoo?
Yeah, that's right,
water.
Now, from my understanding...
These heavenly voices are here. The mistake, or byproduct idea, which I'm espousing, works like this. Natural selection, in ancestral times when we lived in small and stable bands like baboons, programmed into our brains altruistic urges, alongside sexual urges, hunger urges, xenophobic urges, and so on. An intelligent couple today can read their Darwin and know that the ultimate reason for their sexual urges is procreation. They know that the woman cannot conceive because she's on the pill, yet they find that their sexual desire is in no way diminished by the knowledge. Sexual desire is sexual desire, and its force, in an individual's psychology, is independent of the ultimate Darwinian pressure that proved it. It is a strong urge which exists independently of its ultimate rationale. I am suggesting that the same is true of the urge to kindness, to altruism, to generosity, to empathy, to pity. In ancestral times, we had the opportunity to be altruistic only towards close kin and potential reciprocators. Nowadays, that restriction is no longer there, but the rule of thumb persists. Why would it not? It is just like sexual desire. We can no more help ourselves feeling pity when we see a weeping unfortunate who is unrelated and unable to reciprocate, than we can help ourselves feeling lust for a member of the opposite sex, who may be infertile or otherwise unable to reproduce. Both are misfirings, Darwinian mistakes, blessed, precious mistakes. Do not for one moment think of such Darwinizing as demeaning or reductive of the noble emotions of compassion and generosity, nor of sexual desire. Sexual desire, when channeled through conduits of linguistic culture, emerges as great poetry and drama, John Donne's love poems, say, or Romeo and Juliet. And of course, the same thing happens with the misfired redirection of kin and reciprocation-based compassion. Mercy to a debtor is, when seen out of context, as un-Darwinian as adopting someone else's child. The quality of mercy is unstrained. It droppeth as a gentle rain from heaven placed beneath. Sexual lust is the driving force behind a large proportion of human ambition and struggle, and much of it constitutes a misfiring. There is no reason why the same should not be true of the lust to be generous and compassionate. If this is the misfired consequence of ancestral village life, the best way for natural selection to build in both kinds of lust in ancestral times was to install rules of thumb in the brain. These rules still influence us today, even where circumstances make them inappropriate to their original function. Such rules of thumb influence us still, not in a calculistically deterministic way, but filter through the civilizing influences of literature and custom, law and tradition, and of course, religion. Just as the primitive brain rule of sexual lust passes through the filter of civilization to emerge in the love scenes of Romeo and Juliet, so primitive brain rules of us versus them vendetta emerge in the form of the running battles between Capulets and Montagues, while primitive brain rules of altruism and empathy end up in the misfiring that cheers us in the chastened reconciliation of Shakespeare's final scene. Now, another section related. If there is no God, why be good? Posed like that, the question sounds positively ignoble. When a religious person puts it to me in this way, many of them do, my immediate temptation is to issue the following challenge. Do you really need to tell me the only reason you try to be good is to gain God's approval and reward, or to avoid his disapproval and punishment? That's not morality, that's just sucking up. Looking over your shoulder at the surveillance camera in the sky, or the still small wiretap inside your head, monitoring your every move, even your everyday thought. As Einstein said, if people are good only because they fear punishment and hope for reward, then we are a sorry lot indeed. Michael Shermer, in The Science of Good and Evil, calls it the debate stopper. If you agree that in the absence of God, you will commit robbery, rape, and murder, you reveal yourself as an immoral person, and we would be well advised to steer a wide course around you. If, on the other hand, you admit that you will continue to be a good person even when not under divine surveillance, you will fatally undermine your claim that God is necessary for us to be good. It seems to me to require quite a low self-regard to think that, should belief in God suddenly vanish from the world, we would all become callous and selfish hedonists, with no kindness, no charity, no generosity, nothing that would deserve the name of goodness. I'm going to move on now to a chapter called The Good Book and the Shifting Moral Zeitgeist, which is about the allegation that people may get their morals from Scripture, from the Bible. I'm going to begin in the middle, after a fairly horrific passage on some of the more gory chapters of the Old Testament. The ethnic cleansing begun in the time of Moses is brought to bloody fruition in the book of Joshua, a text remarkable for the bloodthirsty massacres it records and the xenophobic rage of which it does so. As the charming old song exultantly has it, Joshua fit the battle of Jericho and the walls came a tumbling down. There's none like good old Joshua of the battle of Jericho. Good old Joshua didn't rest until they utterly destroy all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass, with the edge of the sword. Joshua 6:21. Theologians will protest it didn't happen. Well, no, the story has it that the walls came tumbling down at the near sound of men shouting and blowing horns. So indeed, it didn't happen, but that is not the point. The point is that whether true or not, the Bible is production as a source of our morality. And the Bible story of Joshua's destruction of Jericho and the invasion of the Promised Land in general is morally indistinguishable from Hitler's invasion of Poland or Saddam Hussein's massacres of the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs. The Bible may be an arresting and poetic work of fiction, but it is not the sort of book you should give your children to form their morals. As it happens, the story of Joshua and Jericho is the subject of an interesting experiment in child morality by the Israeli psychologist George Tamarin. Tamarin presented to more than 1,000 Israeli schoolchildren aged between 8 and 14 the account of the Battle of Jericho in the Book of Joshua. Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord hath given you the city. The city and all that is within it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction. But all silver and gold and vessels of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord. Then they utterly destroy all in the city, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep and asses, with the edge of the sword. And they burn the city with fire and all within it. Only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and of iron they put into the treasury, the house of the Lord." Tamarin then asked the children a simple moral question. Do you think Joshua and the Israelites acted rightly or not? They had to choose between A, total approval, B, partial approval, and C, total disapproval. The results were polarized. 66% gave total approval and 26% total disapproval, with rather fewer, 8% in the middle, with partial approval. Here are three typical answers from the total approval A group. In my opinion, Joshua and the sons of Israel acted well, and here are the reasons. God promised them this land and gave them permission to conquer. If they would not have acted in this manner or killed anyone, then there would be the danger that the sons of Israel would have assimilated among the Goyim. In my opinion, Joshua was right when he did it. One reason being that God commanded him to exterminate the people so that the tribes of Israel would not be able to assimilate amongst them and learn their bad ways. Joshua did good because the people who inhabited the land were of a different religion. And when Joshua killed them, he wiped their religion from the earth. The justification for the genocidal massacre by Joshua is religious in every case. Even those in category C who gave total disapproval did so in some cases for backhanded religious reasons. One girl, for example, disapproved of Joshua's conquering Jericho because in order to do so, he had to enter it. I think it is bad, since the Arabs are impure, and if one enters an impure land, one will also become impure and share their curse. Tamarin ran a fascinating control group in his experiment. A different group of 168 Israeli children were given the same text from the Book of Joshua, but with Joshua's own name replaced by General Lin, and Israel replaced by a Chinese kingdom 3,000 years ago. Now the experiment gave opposite results. Only 7% approved of General Lin's behavior, and 75% disapproved. In other words, when their loyalty to Judaism was removed from the calculation, the majority of the children agreed with the moral judgments that most modern humans would share. Joshua's action was indeed a barbaric genocide. But it all looks different from a religious point of view. And the difference starts early in life. It was religion that made the difference between children condemning genocide and condoning it. Do not think, by the way, that the God character nurse any doubts or scruples about the massacres and genocides that accompanied the seizing of the Promised Land. On the contrary, his orders, for example, in Deuteronomy 20, were ruthlessly explicit. He made a clear distinction between the people who lived in the land that was needed and those who lived along their way. The latter should be invited to surrender peacefully. If they refused, all the men were to be killed and the women carried off for breeding. In contrast to this relatively humane treatment, see what was in store for those tribes unfortunate enough to be already in residence in the promised labour's ground. But of the cities of these people, which the Lord thy God doth give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth. But thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites, and the Amorites, the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, the Hevites, and the Jebusites, as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee. Do those people who hold up the Bible as an inspiration to moral rectitude have the slightest notion of what is actually written in it? The following offences merit the death penalty according to Leviticus 20. Cursing your parents, committing adultery, making love to your stepmother or your daughter-in-law, homosexuality, marrying a woman and her daughter, bestiality, and injury to insult the unfortunate beast to be killed too. You also get executed, of course, for working on the Sabbath. The point is made again and again throughout the Old Testament. In Numbers 15, the children of Israel found a man in the wilderness gathering sticks on the forbidden day. They arrested him and then asked God what to do with him. As it turned out, God was in no mood for half measures that day. And the Lord said unto Moses, the man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones without the camp. And all the congregation brought him without the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died. Did this harmless gatherer of firewood have a wife and children to grieve for him? Did he whimper with fear as the first stones flew, and scream with pain as the fusillade crashed into his head? What shocks me today about such stories is not that they really happened, they probably didn't. What makes my jaw drop is that people today should base their lives on such an appalling role model as Yahweh, and even worse, that they should possibly try to force the same evil monster, whether fact or fiction, on the rest of us. The changing moral zeitgeist. Thomas Henry Huxley, by the standards of his times, was an enlightened and liberal progressive. But his times were not ours, and in 1871, he wrote the following. No rational man can neither of the facts believe that the average Negro is the equal, still less the superior, of the white man. And if this be true, it is simply incredible that, when all his disabilities are removed, and our pro-Negro's relative has a fair field in their favour, as well as the oppressor, he will be able to compete successfully with his bigger brain and smaller jawed rival in a contest which is to be carried out by thoughts and not by busts. The highest places in the hierarchy of civilization will assuredly not be within the reach of our dusky cousins. It is a commonplace that good historians don't judge statements from past times by the standards of their own. Abraham Lincoln, like Huxley, was ahead of his time, yet his views on matters of race also sound backwardly racist in ours. Here he is, in a debate in 1858 with Stephen B. Douglas. I will say then that I am not, nor ever have been, in favour of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. That I am not, nor ever have been, in favour of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say, in addition to this, that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favour of having the superior position assigned to the white race. Had Huxley and Lincoln been born and educated in our time, They would have been the first to cringe with the rest of us at their own Victorian sentiments and unctuous tone. I quote them only to illustrate how the zeitgeist moves on. If even Huxley, one of the great liberal minds of his age, and even Lincoln, who freed the slaves, could say such things, just think what the average Victorian must have thought. Going back to the 18th century, it is of course well known that Washington, Jefferson, and other men of the Enlightenment held slaves. The zeitgeist moves on, so inexorably that we sometimes take it for granted and forget that the change is a real phenomenon in its own right. There are numerous other examples. The swinging 60s are legendary for their liberal modernity. But at the beginning of that decade, a prosecuting barrister in the trial for obscenity of Lady Chatterley's lover could still ask the jury, would you approve of your young sons, young daughters, because girls can read as well as boys? Can you believe he said that? Reading this book, is it a book you read lying around in your own house? Is it a book you even wish your wife or your servants to read? This last rhetorical question is a particularly stunning illustration of the speed with which the zeitgeist changes. The American invasion of Iraq is widely condemned for its civilian casualties. Yet these casualty figures are orders of magnitude lower than comparable numbers for the Second World War. There seems to be a steadily shifting standard of what is morally acceptable. Donald Rumsfeld, who sounds so callous and odious today, would have sounded like a beating heart liberal if he'd heard the same things during the Second World War. Something has shifted in the intervening decades. It has shifted in all of us, and the shift has no connection with religion. If anything, it happens in spite of religion, not because of it. The shift is in a recognizably consistent direction, which most of us would judge as improvement. Even Adolf Hitler, widely regarded as pushing the envelope of evil into uncharted territory, would not have stood out in a time of Caligula or of Genghis Khan. Hitler no doubt killed more people than Genghis, but he had 20th century technology at his disposal. And did even Hitler gain his greatest pleasure, as Genghis avowedly did, from seeing his victims near and dear bathed in tears? We judge Hitler's degree of evil by the standards of today, and the moral zeitgeist has moved on since Caligula's time, just as the technology has. Hitler seems especially evil only by the more benign standards of our time. In a previous book, I quoted H.G. Wells' Utopian New Republic, and I shall do so again because it is such a shocking illustration of the point I'm making. And how will the New Republic treat the inferior races? How will it deal with the black, the yellow man, the Jew, those swarms of black and brown and dirty white and yellow people who do not come into the new needs of efficiency? Well, the world is a world and not a charitable institution, and I take it they will have to go. And the ethical system of these men of the New Republic, the ethical system which will dominate the world state, will be shaped primarily to favor the procreation of what is fine and efficient and beautiful in humanity. Beautiful and strong bodies, clear and powerful minds. And the method that nature has followed hitherto in the shaping of the world, whereby weakness was prevented from propagating weakness, is death. The men of the New Republic will have an ideal that will make the killing worth the while. That was written in 1902, and Wells was regarded as a progressive in his own time. In 1902, such sentiments, while not widely agreed, would have made for an acceptable dinner party argument. Modern readers, by contrast, literally gasp with horror when they see the words. We are forced to realize that Hitler, appalling though he was not quite as far outside the zeitgeist of his time as he seems from our vantage point today. How swiftly the zeitgeist changes. It moves in parallel on a broad front throughout the educated world. Where, then, have these concerted and steady changes in social consciousness come from? The onus is not on me to answer. For my purposes, it is sufficient that they certainly have not come from religion. For my purposes, it is enough that, as a matter of observed fact, it does move. It is not driven by religion and certainly not by scripture. it is probably not a single force like gravity, but a complex interplay of disparate forces, like the one that propels Moore's law, describing the exponential increase in computer power. Whatever its cause, the manifest phenomenon of Zeitgeist progression is more than enough to undermine the claim that we need God in order to be good, or to decide what is good. Thank you very much.